Welcome to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my co-host and mother, Caroline Kilborn. Hi, Mom.
Hi. Nice and cool today.
Beautiful day. Beautiful day in Iowa.
Yes,
and we are talking to somebody who's way far away from Iowa today and from the United States. Who is our guest today, Mom?
Our guest today, is Brad Fox. And he's the author of a novel, To Remain Nameless. And you'll see why To Remain Nameless is a good title for this.
And tell us a little bit about Brad.
Well, Brad Fox's stories, articles, and translations have appeared in The New Yorker. I'm not sure how to pronounce this. Guernica,
and maybe?
And the Whitney Biennial. From 1996 to 2011, he worked as a journalist, researcher, and relief contractor in the Balkans, Mexico, the Middle East, and Turkey. And he teaches at City College in Harlem. He's had a lot of experiences in what he's talking about in this book, and so that's what makes it so interesting. And welcome to Writer's Voices, Brad.
Hi, thanks.
So where are you now?
So right now I'm outside of the town of Tarapoto in kind of northeastern Peru. I've been here since March 9th.
And I'm guessing that you weren't intending to stay quite that long.
Yeah, so I came down thinking I would be down here for 12 days. And in the middle of that 12-day period, the country declared a state of emergency and shut down domestic travel and sealed the borders and implemented a curfew and lots of different restrictions related to the pandemic. And so there were these kinds of two-week, they would say, oh, it's going to go another 2 weeks. Then it was going to go another month. And so now we're still here 6 months later. So,
aren't allowed to leave.
I mean, there are ways to leave if I needed to. It would require, at this point, the conditions have kind of changed, but at this point, the way I would get home would be, I could take my chances on a domestic flight, but they've been continued to be canceled, or take a bus, like a 30-hour bus ride to Lima, where you can get these repatriation flights that are, you know, they're called humanitarian flights, but they're actually can be a few thousand dollars. And, you know, you have to get special government permission to travel, et cetera. So it's still expensive and time consuming, difficult. But it has been done. People that came with us have, for different reasons. We just had there was a group of six that came. And for example, our group was a firefighter and resigned while he was here and had to get back in order to sign a piece of paper in person. Otherwise, they were going to deprive him of his pension. So he decided that was worth it. So he made the long trip to Lima and I think is flying to Miami today.
Okay.
But for me, I'm not on the teaching schedule this semester, which anyway would be happening online. So I'm just here writing, and my partner is a therapist and is working online as we would be, you know, so doing the same thing we would be in New York.
So you got to miss the whole New York lockdown.
I missed entirely the New York lockdown. Instead I had the Tarapoto lockdown.
And but was that the same as, you know, not leaving your apartment kind of thing?
It's different in the sense that we're at the edge of the jungle. We're in kind of the high jungle where the Andes overlap with the Amazon. And so you're hardly ever indoors. And so even though we couldn't leave the place where we're staying, is like a couple of walls with screens in the middle of a garden next to a river. So in that sense, it's a whole lot nicer than it would have been if we were stuck in our apartment in Manhattan.
And how is
trying
it,
not to use so
yeah how is it like getting yeah. food to eat there?
I think it's easier than it would be at home, just in the sense that we've got a couple of fruit stands right down the street, so even when there would be the curfew, we could still go there and people would have, you know, papayas, bananas, potatoes, that kind of thing. Now and then they'd have a chicken. So it hasn't been hard. And then when the lockdown first happened here, so this is the kind of the joke or whatever you want to call it, but there were very few cases in Peru when the pandemic hit, and the country reacted strongly and quickly and closed the border and stopped travel and implemented all these measures, and it just didn't work because people don't have a refrigerator, so they have to go to the market every day. And so the virus spread, and so then it became so. But at the beginning, it was there. The measures were to keep the virus out. And then in the months that we've been here, Peru's gone from being like largely unaffected to one of the worst places in the world. And this part of Peru is one of the worst parts of Peru. So now the measures are in place to keep the virus in. And we haven't left, you know. So, I mean, it's just kind of different levels of irony. But, I mean, on one hand, it's been terrible in the sense that, like New York was in April, there have been these scenes of bodies outside the hospital and, you know, lots of people died. And at the same time, I personally have been in a pretty beautiful garden surrounded by hummingbirds and toucans and the occasional monkey and, you know, working on my work at the edge of a river. Like, it's been very beautiful.
And for anyone, you know, maybe an American to get stranded in a, I don't know if Peru is considered third world, but, you know,
do we use that term anymore?
I don't know. I don't know. But in a remote location like this, I guess you are probably the best person to do that because you've had experience in remote exotic locations. You want to tell us a little bit about your history?
Sure. I mean, yeah, I grew up in not far from you all in Kansas City. So that was where I lived until I was 17. And then I ended up in New York, kind of finished my undergraduate work in New York and left the country pretty much right away around my 22nd birthday. And I spent, like my whole 20s and my adult life in mostly in ex-Yugoslavia and then in Berlin, Mexico, Cairo, Syria before the war, Istanbul, and doing a lot of different things, but a lot of work with refugee and asylum issues and writing magazine articles and you know, that kind of thing. So I guess in that sense, being, you know, upheavals and having to take it day by day because you don't know what's going to go on that's a situation that I guess I've been in before. And like my Spanish is pretty good, so it would be a different thing if I was stuck in a country where I had to learn the language from scratch or something, but on one hand it's like I'm happy to work on my Spanish and I've been reading a lot in Spanish, which has been nice. And so that all makes being here, I suppose, a little bit less shocking than it might be for the flexibility.
For the average tourist, yeah.
I suppose, yeah. But I was here with the group that came here, there was one of our people that we came together with was a molecular biologist from northern Serbia, so we could speak Serbian together, which was funny. And somehow there was something very odd about sitting at the edge of the Amazon speaking Serbian that seemed to connect like different parts of my life in a surprising way.
There's a scene in your novel that's a little bit like that, where the main character Tess is remembering being in Egypt and meeting a former someone from Slovenia, and she had spent a lot of time in that part of the world and wanting to talk to him, but being hesitant to you know, why don't you describe that scene a little bit?
So the scene is, so Tess is an American woman who has spent several years in the former Yugoslavia and really acculturated to specifically to kind of Sarajevo and Belgrade, but mostly Sarajevo, and kind of identified with the culture there, and certainly the language was something that she learned and made her own, and thought a lot about the ex-Yugoslavia as a place that no longer existed, but she kind of identified with. And then she finds herself in Egypt, and she's with an Argentine woman who wants to take her to meet a friend of hers, who turns out to be who is a guy who lives on a houseboat in the Nile. And so they go to visit him, and he turns out to be from Slovenia. And so she's wants to connect with him as somebody who has a relationship with former Yugoslavia, but he's since converted to Islam and changed his name and is really shows no interest in connecting with that part of his past. So they have these kind of very different relationships with it that kind of ends up, at least from her side, as a kind of mistrust of who this guy is. And it seems she's thinking about him having reinvented himself as a, you know, a kind of Muslim intellectual sitting on a houseboat, and feels him to be a poser, as if she knows something about his past that others around him might not.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Brad Fox, who's speaking with us from the jungle of Peru, the edge of the jungle of Peru, and he's the author of To Remain Nameless.
And could I say, I think you should really write a novel about your experiences with COVID and all the things that have happened. No, really, I do. I think that would be, because, you know, in the future, people are, they're going to forget about this. They really are. And especially young people. And this would be interesting. It would be very interesting.
I think it's very interesting. And so I've been doing interviews with people. I've been filling notebooks with our firefighter, our molecular biologist, people who ended up here, left the States from different circumstances and responded to what's going on here in different ways. And interviewed people from here, and how we've been studying with a traditional medicine practitioner from here who, you know, is a Quechua speaking guy from the town of Lamas, which is a particular indigenous community here. And so it's been interesting to hear his take on the pandemic. If you think of an indigenous community in the Americas that has seen pandemics come and go over, you know, the last several centuries. And there's been so many different ways to see what's going on globally sitting in this corner of the jungle, which I find it fascinating. I don't know what story I'm going to tell from it, but I do feel like that there is something unique in what we've been through and seen from here. So I'm glad you agree.
Absolutely.
Wow. I get what you're saying about how for you it's like life isn't normal, but it's actually quite nice through this pandemic. For me, it's really in some ways completely different, and in some ways really very normal. You know, I live in a small town. I don't go out to eat. I don't go into any stores, so forth. But my job takes up, my business is, we had a real slowdown when things were shut down, and we didn't know how the year was going to be. But now it's doing, you know, we're doing a lot of business, and it's a design and manufacturing company. And we were kind of really involved in the whole, COVID pandemic before most people, really, because we manufacture in China. We have factories in China as well as the U.S. And so we were very aware of what was going on before most people were. And it's actually, I've had to work longer and harder. I haven't had a day off since January. You know, because of dealing with all the things that came up and the personnel issues and shutting this factory down and, okay, now we can reopen this one. Uh-oh, somebody tested positive. We got to shut down again. You know, just juggling all of that along with the normal things. So I know there's people out there who don't have anything to do during this. Mm-hmm. They don't have work and they're stuck at home. Yeah. But for me, there's...
Yeah, the people that have a couple of kids running around. I mean,
yeah.
I think about that a lot. But, trying to write while you're taking care of a toddler or something
seems
impossible.
Oh,
but
yeah.
So exactly, I feel incredibly fortunate considering what people have gone through. So I have a close friend who's an emergency doctor in New York who I talked to about 3 weeks before I left to come to Peru. And he was telling me, I'm just waiting for a civilization-altering pandemic to sweep through and for there to be lines outside my emergency room. And at that point, it was still a little bit possible to think of that as a joke, you know, a little bit far-fetched or something. And then very, very quickly, he was sending these dispatches of just these horrible situations of having to make decisions about who to tend to as people were in different, you know, parts of the process of the illness or dying.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, people have gone through incredible things and lost relatives and whatever. So, I mean, I feel like, although I find what the people that I'm in touch with here have, I think that there's something unique and valuable about our perspective on it. At the same time, it's been relatively pleasant, you know?
So, yeah. And, you know, what Mom just said about that kids or, you know, that people might not remember this and might not be aware of it. And we need these stories. Right at the beginning of this, the last time that I saw my grandkids who live in the Austin, Texas area, and my granddaughter's turning 8 today.
Happy birthday.
Yeah. And so the last time I saw them before we weren't allowed to see each other, and then I ended up coming back up to Iowa, so I haven't seen them since March. They were worried about it, about COVID, and I was explaining that, you know, kids don't tend to get sick from it and they didn't need to worry too much. And then I was talking about how it seems like in every generation, there's some really significant life-changing event that happens in the world. And it may not have a direct impact on you, but it changes your life in ways that you can't even realize. And so they wanted examples of that. I said, this is probably going to be that for you, for your generation. And they wanted examples. So I was talking about 9/11, and they were not, my grandson who was 10 kind of knew what that was or had heard of it, but knew very little about it. And my granddaughter knew nothing at all. And then I had to be careful about what exactly I said, because I didn't want to terrify them. But this is, you know, it is a significant life-changing event, and it's possible that, like right now, there's tons of people writing World War II stories, and, you know, 50 years from now, there may be tons of people writing COVID pandemic stories.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's so many unbelievable things that have come out of this, and so many abrupt changes in experience that's made everybody so aware of how they live and what's been important to them and what they miss. I mean, it's, you know, like it or not, it makes you reflect. So.
Yes. Yeah.
I grew up during the Second World War and I was born in 35. So, you know, I can remember some things about, we had rationing and everything and the newsreels, always every movie you went to, there was always a newsreel about what was going on in the war. That's very true. History has to
definitely
we have to record history.
It's like an epoch-defining event for sure. I mean, and in some way, I was talking to the novelist Claire Massoud, who's a professor of mine and a friend of mine, about how this kind of like closes the 9/11 period. That in some way, everything that happened after 9/11 was so defined by that, especially for those of us who lived outside the U.S., because U.S. foreign policy, you know, was all of a sudden just so much a part of everybody's life, and how with the collapse of U.S. power because of the current government or whatever, and the pandemic, it's just that period of kind of American
imperialism,
whatever you want to call it. Yeah, well, and I mean, a certain kind of chapter in American imperialism, because American imperialism is much older than that. But that particular misguided and wasteful and murderous chapter that was opened with 9/11. Yeah, I feel like it's will be closed. And I guess I've had some experiences in the sense that, so I was away, I lived away from the U.S. for 15 years, and I moved back in 2011, and right around at the end of August. So, and I moved back to New York, and it was right around the 10th anniversary of 9/11 when I got there. And so I was in touching down to my native country, was all of a sudden, you know, connected to the way that that event was remembered. And so that was instructive in many ways, but it was also interesting to see how all of these events that had been so definitive for me, the wars in the Balkans, 9/11, the Arab Spring, you know, how abstract things became and were seen in different ways. And I understood that it was as if I would meet a Vietnam vet and who was coming back, and how hard it would be for me to understand what they were talking about. So I had to like be aware of that generational thing and just how different the experiences were, and try to overcome that in just the way that I communicated with people when I came back. So
you're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Brad Fox, who is the author of the novel To Remain Nameless. So let's talk a little more about the book. We introduced Tess briefly,
mm-hmm.
but what's the kind of the underlying theme and story in this novel?
Okay. Yeah. In some way, it's very simple. It takes place over the course of about 12 hours in a hospital room near Columbus Circle in Manhattan, in the labor and delivery ward of St. Luke's Roosevelt Hospital. And there are two women who are in the room together, and one of them is giving birth and the other is trying to help. And so Tess is the woman who's trying to help, and she is there with her old friend Laura, who is giving birth. And most of the book takes place in Tess's mind and her memory. And so it's going over the relationship that these two friends have. And so they have been colleagues in different places in the humanitarian industry. They met in 99 in working through the Kosovo airstrikes, and then reconnected in Egypt and in Istanbul, doing different kinds of work. And so as Laura is giving birth and Tess is trying to help her, she's also replaying these scenes from their experiences together, and in some way kind of wondering what it all means. And that's what the book is in some ways about. Is so you have a woman who is pretty devastated and heartbroken and has seen, you know, the worst that the human being can produce, and is there confronted by a new life from her friend. And so her pessimism is forced to confront this thing that's happening, and that's basically what is happening over the course of the 240 pages of the book.
Would you like to read a little from the opening?
Sure. Yeah.
Great.
I will read. I'm just going to read the first chapter, which is about 4 pages long. Okay, so this is To Remain Nameless. Only immediate family, the triage receptionist said. Your friend can wait right here. It'll just be a minute or two. Tess watched Laura about to protest with her flushed face and heaving belly. How can you argue with a woman in labor? A nurse stood at the swinging doors, trying to lead her patient back into the examination room, but Laura planted both feet and turned to Tess. You promised you won't let them give me an epidural, remember? I want to feel everything. Tess nodded, brown hair falling in her face. I'm sure I'll ask for drugs. I'm scared and weak, but don't listen to me. As the nurse started to lead her away, Laura pointed at the piece of paper Tess held in her hand. I'll ask, Laura said, but you have cotton in your ears. Remember, I want to feel everything. The doors to the examination room swung shut, leaving Tess under the buzzing lights of triage. She looked down at the paper. Across the top, it read, Laura Valerio, birth plan. And there it was, item number one. I am a weakling and a coward. Tess laughed out loud as she sought her bearings, alone now for the first time in days. Laura, a coward and a weakling, how could she ever believe that? But she'd never felt a labor contraction, had no idea how intense it could be. She dropped down into a black vinyl chair against the wall, the room empty except for the triage receptionist, now talking on the phone with a big smile across her face. Immediate? Who was more immediate than Tess? She felt the cold, air-conditioned air through the loose shirt she wore. She crossed and uncrossed her legs, head steel reeling. She looked down at the sparkling tiles. Labor, she thought. Now it's starting. Once in the village above Aswan, there'd been a woman in labor, and as they waited for the midwife, the woman had made such strange noises that Tess walked out into the whitewashed alleyways and paced up and down, stopping in front of the old tomb to ask the dead sheikh what that sound could be. And now Laura at 39, who abandoned Tess in the Istanbul office to come back and nurse her own mother on her deathbed, to sit uncomplainingly as her mother wasted away after working through crisis after crisis, war and famine and development assignment. Now she was in triage, asking for drugs. Give me drugs. Tess stood back up and took a step toward the door. There was hardly room to pace in here. Her body was awkward and she wished she could be inside with Laura, wished she knew what there was to do. Wish she'd learned everything there was to learn. What had the Egyptian midwife known? Surely there were things to do in this situation that didn't involve inserting a tube into your spine. Laura had begged her to be here. Laura, who had never asked her for anything. It's a pain unlike any other. That's what I hear. Please be with me. But I don't know anything about it, Tess told her. I don't know anything. It doesn't matter. I want you with me. You have to be there. So she flew from Ataturk Airport and landed at JFK, and 5 days later, here she was, 7:48 p.m., 12th floor of St. Luke's Roosevelt, just down from Columbus Circle. 5 days, and it was like she'd been excised from her life. Could hardly remember what awaited her, the caseload, the swelling camps, the endless state of emergency. All that was far away, and she was here in this waiting room, too small to pace in, pushing her knee against the black vinyl of the chair. The triage nurse gabbing away on the phone, and Tess could understand every word. Could not understand, really. That was closer to the situation. Back in the U.S., here in this unfamiliar New York, everyone all around speaking her language. When she landed, she thought they must be speaking to her, a colleague or a voice over the phone. Did you find out where they're being held? And how long is the extension? After 5 days, she still wasn't used to it. Found herself turning her head involuntarily on the street. Who said that? Who was that? Suspicious, a little paranoid. Relax, she told herself. This is your home country. You have every right to be here. It's important to Laura and these friendships formed in such conditions that had lasted this long. It's important to hold on to something. What else does she have? She had to be here, to be a true friend at least. If Laura was going to cry and suffer and birth a baby in New York, then she would come. The guy was supposed to be around somewhere, but Tess still hadn't seen a sign of him, whoever he was. Laura too proud to push him, probably. But she could ask Tess, and she knew Tess would come if she could, and she did, and she had. But Tess hadn't expected the triage nurse to make her wait here in the waiting room just a minute or two. They lie, Tess thought. She listened for Laura screaming her head off in the next room, about to give birth, for God's sake, to bring new life into the world, to add another version of herself. Madness. In this country, empire crumbling, waters rising, Manhattan turned over to bankers and tourists. And this receptionist on the phone, where did she live? Her slight Caribbean lilt. Parents from Trinidad or something, that melody. People of this city, this hemisphere. Never heard that accent in all the places she lived. Did she ever hear that beautiful Caribbean lilt on the streets of Istanbul? A Bronx accent among the doctors in Kosovo? There was a guy from Harlem in Macedonia. What was his name? Richard Bright or something like that. Or who said he was from Harlem? Who knows where he was from? A white man from Harlem with his bald head and his yellow eyes, with his straight spine and his very correct way of speaking. flattened, stilted, any character hammered out like he'd been printed out or was an iteration of something. Later he said he'd lived in Utah or somewhere, Montana, had moved out west from Harlem to teach survivalism. They were sure he was some kind of agent. Everyone was supposedly some kind of agent, but Richard Bright, with his survivalism and his hammered-out accent, was maybe more likely than others. How long had it taken him to learn to talk like that, perfectly stilted and proper and underneath menacing? Is that how they talk in Utah and Montana? Back home in Kansas City, her half-brother Max used to tell her about his neighbors in the southern suburbs with their big smiles and their clipped lawns and their children locked up in the basement, body parts buried in the backyard. "Eat the liver," Richard Bright said. "If you're trapped in the mountains and the only food is the body of another person, eat the liver first. That's the most nutritious part." When she met him, the way everyone met in those circles, but that didn't stop Laura from going to bed with him, or had it, his shiny bald head bobbing up and down. Go for the liver. One thing you could say about Laura, she'd always wanted to feel everything. So that is chapter one.
And that's Brad Fox reading from To Remain Nameless. So Richard Bright, I know that this book was written and published before that name became sort of not quite a household name, but hit the media this spring. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I don't know what you're talking about. I must not have been in that same spring.
So, well, you weren't in the U.S., but... Dr. Richard Bright is the highest-ranking government scientist to charge the federal government's response to the coronavirus pandemic has been slow and chaotic. He says it prioritized politics over science and cost people their lives, and it cost him his job. So he got kicked out of the Department of Health and Human Services.
Okay, that's great. This is the kind of agent we needed.
So
I mean, it is one of those names, right? It's destined to come up somewhere.
Yes, yeah, but it's just interesting that it came up now.
It is interesting. Yeah. Well, thank you for filling me in.
Right.
I've been living in ignorance of what's become of my characters, and then reinventing themselves on the government stage.
Brad, I know that a lot of the places that you write about, and the things that you write about in Kosovo and Turkey, Egypt, that you've been there, you've seen what's going on, you've been involved in this work, and I can certainly see why you would incorporate those experiences into a novel. But what I'm curious about is why you decided to do it in this way, being told from a female point of view and with a woman giving birth. What was it that brought – why is that the way to tell this story?
There's a couple of reasons. On one hand, there is somewhere in the drawers of my hard drive, there's another novel where I dealt with these stories in a different way, where Tess is an important character but not the main character, and Laura is a very minor character. So these were characters that I had kind of written about and lived with for a while, and then my partner was working as a birth doula. And so when we first moved to New York, she's Hungarian, and when we first moved to New York, she that was just her way of getting started working. And so from right away of arriving there, she was, you know, on call and then would rush off to these, you know, hospital situations, and she'd come back 2 days later without having slept and tell me the story of what happened. And they were always these incredible, epic stories of what happens when a person who's giving birth being pushed beyond what they thought would ever be asked of them physically, and then also what happens to the people around them. So the struggle with the medical system, and also just everybody's layers peel off and fall off, and all their defenses are down by you know, after 36 hours in the hospital. And so all of the stories were just fascinating to me. And then there was – and so – without explicitly making a decision to do this, there was just a moment one morning when I got up and I just wrote a scene of these two characters, minor characters, in this other book that I had been trying to write. in this, basically what I just read right now, it hasn't changed all that much of just that scene of arriving and to the hospital. And it was just one of these moments when once that conceit, you know, appeared to me, it seemed perfect. This is how all of the issues that I'm interested in come into play, and how the sprawl of life and history can be contained in a tellable story. And and then, you know, so I'm a guy who doesn't have children. I have seen one. I've been in the room for one birth because some friends of mine who were giving birth, like a couple that I was very close to, just brought me with them before I thought about writing about it. But so I saw that incredible event happen once. But so, you know, and then it's one of those things of like, do I have the right to do this? And then, you know, I struggled with that to some degree, but it seemed like it was already happening. And so it seemed very strange to put it aside. And it seemed like a better challenge to see it through and see what I could learn from that.
And you had a built-in resource to check the accuracy.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I talked about it with a lot of women who've given birth, and there's some issues. There's certain things that women would be like, actually, that's not a good position at this stage, and that, you know, like, I would not be on my back at this moment, and I'm like, yeah, I understand that. But basically, I did spend time, like, kind of went back to the hospital and was like, what's in the room? And, I had my, my birth doula friend who could tell me no end of stories about what's happening, and really understood also physiologically what's happening to the human body during birth. And which was something that I was interested in, of like seeing how much I could capture of just that animal experience, from using what I could learn and my imagination, and just trying to feel my way into that experience from the outside.
So, Mom, you've had 5 kids. How did this resonate with you?
Well, you know, this is true, that there's something that helps you forget all the pain. I don't know what that is, but it does. Actually, when you were born, it took an hour.
Yeah, and, I know.
Yeah.
I was in a hurry.
Yes, you were. So, yeah, but you know, I know I didn't have this much pain, I don't think. I probably had something. I don't know if they gave me something or not, but can't remember. That was a long time ago.
Well, that is true. That is true, since your baby is, what, 54 maybe by now? 53, 54?
Yeah, right.
and my baby's in her 30s, so it's been a while for me, too.
No, but it's true. There is something that something in your brain that, you know, helps you forget. So otherwise, you would probably only have one.
Yeah. Well, you know, I had the same thing where I didn't want to have drugs. And when I was going to the hospital with my second, with my daughter, it happened really fast too. I have a great birth story where the doctor actually had to drive me to the hospital because it was happening so fast. And, I had gone in for a doctor appointment, a checkup, and it's like, uh-oh, we got to get you to the hospital now. and also it was the first baby that he had delivered on his own. He was a brand new doctor, so it was pretty exciting.
Oh my God!
Yeah, and but I remember at one point he said, either he or one of the nurses said, "Do you want some painkiller?" And I'm like, "I will tell you if I want some painkiller."
You were feisty. Yeah.
I was feisty, yeah. And it all happened really fast. And when it was done, the doctor said, "Well, that was easy." And I'm like, well, that was easy for you to say.
For you. Right? Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, that's good.
Yeah. So is this your first novel, Brad?
No. I mean, it's my first novel to come out in the U.S. It's my first novel. But I wrote a novel in English, but that I never sent out to anybody. I wrote it when I was living in the Balkans, I didn't even know you could write a book, and I didn't know what to do with it once I'd written it. And then a friend of mine there borrowed it, like, was like, can I see what you've done? And then gave it to a friend of hers who was a novelist, a Serbian novelist, and he translated it and published it. And so it was kind of a little bit like, so it was published in Serbian, and then that was translated into Macedonian, and parts of it were translated into Arabic and other languages, but it was never published in English. And you know, now it's like something I wrote in my early 20s. It's very nice that it exists in the process of being translated. So that was my first process of being published, was to be translated. And that was fascinating and wonderful, to have the translator ask me questions on a very detailed level about why I made certain decisions so that he could figure out how to translate it. And so having to really think hard about what I was doing. But anyway, so that book came out. Nobody read it. I mean, people read it in over there. But it had a life. It was interesting. All the release events were in Serbian, which was so I was it was incredible. And then there was the other, like, manuscript that I mentioned, which is also unedited. That was kind of like the preliminary work for this book. So,
right.
But so this is my first book to come out in English in the U.S.
And
so,
tell us your story of how you got published.
I had asked a professor of mine if he had any idea who might be interested. And I'd had a lot of trouble with the agent world. Like, I had an agent, but, you know, that relationship wasn't going that well. And I don't know, I just wasn't, it wasn't really, it wasn't feeling very good, the regular channels. And so I was just asking this professor of mine, who was a translator. And so he knew about this editor who had worked at, what was it called? I can't remember the name of the press. It doesn't exist anymore. Anyway, and he was like, oh, look for her. And so I was like, oh, that press doesn't exist, but it looks like she started a new press, which was Rescue. And so I sent it to her, to Hillary Plum. They're looking for, I don't know what's exactly how they describe it, hybrid, chaotic, adventurous stuff. And so she, Hillary, gratefully, you know, liked it. And the Rescue is, I have nothing but good things to say about them. They're fabulous. And I felt so lucky to work with them. And they publish basically a book of poetry and a book of prose a year.
Oh, wow.
So they really take a lot of time. So it was just so luxurious to be able to have so much care and attention to go through it so closely. That was the story, connecting with Rescue.
And the book came out in May, I believe?
Yeah, so it came out in May, and then, of course, it came out during the pandemic. So all of my events that were supposed to happen were canceled, like everybody. And so then I've done whatever I can do from here online, being, in this garden where I live. So that's been very strange. I mean, on one hand, who knows what the pandemic, I mean, of all, you know, it's like a lot of people lost everything during the pandemic, and in some way book publishing and that kind of thing has, you know, I don't know how it was affected. I hear that books that came out during those first few months of the pandemic didn't do as well, but who knows? I mean, this is a literary novel. I mean, who knows what the market even means. It's the kind of thing that hopefully will have a long life, and it will
Right.
And it will not be determined by what happened in the first couple of months of its release.
Yeah.
But it has been very interesting. I mean, it's been like I've been stuck here, but then all of the world went online, so I've been able to do what I needed to do. And, you know, it's
well,
been
that's a good point. That's a good point. Now, one of the places that Tess and Laura worked and lived was Turkey. And I think people, maybe in general in the U.S., are not all that aware of what's going on in Turkey in terms of the refugee crisis, how large the camps are there, how many people have ended up in Turkey from so many different nations in that part of the world.
Yeah, I mean,
I'm a little more familiar with it because I spent a couple of weeks on Lesbos about a year ago in May, and
just had this tragic fire.
Yeah, that camp. I actually worked with some of the. Just one day, I helped with a jewelry making class at this little school that was right outside the camp for women and children from that camp to come to. So I met people who lived there. And, of course, the Moria camp was designed to hold 3,000 people, and it had 12,000 living there. And just the whole thing was tragic. But tell us a little more about how all these people ended up in Turkey, and then how...
Well, there's so many different stories. So, I mean, when I was dealing with the organization that dealt with asylum issues in Turkey, it was before the war in Syria had started. So that meant... although the war in Iraq had been going on for a long time because the border situation, the relationship with the Kurdish areas of northern Iraq, there wasn't that many Iraqis in Turkey. But what there were people from all over the world. There were plenty of Afghans and Iranian people that had, you know, come in a way that you would think of more logically. But there were people from Congo, from all over Africa, who... And basically,
Sudan. I think I met some from Sudan.
Yeah.
Cameroon.
Definitely people from Sudan. Yeah. From all over the continent. What started to become clear was that the coyotes who were, you know, shuttling people across the Mediterranean would say that they were going to take people to Europe and would drop them off in Turkey because it was easier to do that. The borders were more porous, and so you would have people that would arrive on the coast of Anatolia thinking that they were in Greece or Europe somewhere, and then they would end up in this legal limbo because they had absolutely no status, because Turkey would not allow refugee status to people who, unless they had arrived from Europe, which is a legal qualification that comes from the 19th century and the early 20th century, but which they had never changed. And and then the war in Syria started, and then you just had this enormous influx, millions of people. And all of a sudden there was a whole huge change of these major, major refugee camps down along the border with Syria, and then a huge population in Istanbul, entire neighborhoods. It was a major shift, and that forced the Turkish government to think about refugee issues in a different way. So there's no way they could have maintained this denial of what a refugee was in the face of the situation in Syria. So then they tried to kind of take advantage of it, so extend certain rights in order to give voting rights to Syrian refugees, and so that the ruling party could probably claim their support. There are different ways that it was manipulated. It was very difficult to work with that government dealing with refugee issues. So,
and also, I think the European Union was paying them a lot to keep the refugees there.
Yeah, just bribing them to keep the refugees. Yeah, exactly. So, the camps are always at triple the population that they're designed for. You know what I mean? It's just like...
I can't even fathom what it would be like to be in one of these camps, and that could be your life for 20 years, and you don't know.
Right.
You don't know.
Right, exactly. I mean, you have neighborhoods in Damascus that are, you know, refugee camps from Palestinians, and obviously Lebanon.
I met a couple from Beirut when I was there, and wonderful couple. She was actually from somewhere in Northern Europe originally, but he was from Beirut. And I didn't know that, first of all, they were Christian, not Muslim. So there are still Lebanese Christians, but the number of people living in Lebanon that are refugees is like creeping up to be almost as many as there are native Lebanese there.
I don't know the exact number, but it's certainly a huge percentage.
And then
just with this explosion, that just it's horrible.
So with all of that going on in the world, and you've seen so much of it, how do you like just put that aside so you can write?
Writing has been a way to engage that and try to make things meaningful and try to see what I've learned. In some ways writing is an exploration of your experience to try to see what's in there, So,
absolutely.
So it's rather than putting it aside, it's more like how to engage with it respectfully, properly, and lovingly somehow. So because there's a lot of ways that it can just be. You meet a lot of people who work in situations that deal with armed conflict or refugee issues that seem very emotionally abstract, and so, which is just a coping mechanism, So on one hand, there's a lot of black humor and all those things, which are great. But, although I have worked in such circumstances, I also did a lot of other things. I wasn't somebody who just was a NGO worker for 15 years. And so I wasn't somebody who had to maintain that kind of emotional abstraction over many years, which I think would be harder to then turn around and have a different relationship with. So my interactions with it were intense, but were punctuated by other ways of life.
Were you writing throughout that?
I've always been writing in different ways, So I've been writing, editing, translating, writing for myself, writing for other people, in all different ways. So I've always been writing. So sometimes there are things that I can go back to, and sometimes they're not. But it's certainly always been a way of dealing with experience.
But one thing I found interesting was, When Tess was first back in the United States to help her friend, and she was out walking around and people were speaking English, and she thought everybody was talking to her. she was so used to foreign language, people in foreign language in foreign countries that didn't speak English, that I thought, gee, that would be interesting, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
You think everybody was talking to her.
Is that an experience, something that you experienced?
Yeah, that's definitely
personally?
An experience that I've had. And I feel like I'm not alone in having that experience when your antenna is just so scrambled, it's so confusing. I definitely remember that moving back after quite a while. And it's not like I hadn't heard English, but there's just something about ambient English being something that I didn't hear very often. Yeah. And, I'd be someplace abroad and that you'd hear somebody speaking English just across the room and you can just hear it like, it just drills into your mind from across the room. And so that's one thing. But then just when it was all over the place, it's just very confusing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I know. Whenever I'm traveling abroad and I hear English, it's like you feel like, oh, you must have some connection with this person. Or as a... When I was traveling as a tourist, you'd see other people with the Rick Steves tour guide in Europe. And then it's like and you always had like this knowing, yep, that's, we have something in common.
Yeah, we have the same, we're following the same map, right?
The same guidebook, how to get, how to do Europe on, without going broke, basically.
Yeah.
So Were you always, when you were writing and traveling in these other countries, did you always have a computer, or do you sometimes have to rely on old pen and paper?
You know, it's funny. The first time so the book that was published in translation, it was kind of right after the airstrikes of 99, and I had done a couple of different contracts, and then there was this several month period where I didn't have work, and there was a very cheap apartment in Budapest that some friends of mine had offered me, like $100 a month or something. And so I was like, I'm going to go and sit there and write. So I went to Budapest and I moved in this apartment, and, you know, kind of having never done this before, it was kind of like open the computer to, you know, open a new file and be like, now I'm going to write something. And then the computer crashed that first day. And so immediately I was like, you know, life is you know, foiled again. And so then I in the course of trying to get the computer fixed, I started writing longhand, and I wrote that first book longhand. It's still something that I still write a lot longhand, but like working on something where there's like about speed and tempo and the ways that your mind can flow into written language, which is different in the computer or on paper.
It is.
And so, yeah. And so the you just write slower with a pen. And so, so it makes you think in a different way. And I think it's really helpful to switch from one to the other in over the course of trying to struggle with something. It usually gives you fresh perspective.
And also, if you write longhand and then type it into the computer, that can give you like another opportunity to really feel what you're writing.
Yeah, I mean, it's like even I've heard of people who write on the computer and then print it out and erase the file.
Oh.
So they have to retype from the hard copy. Just because that makes you do another revision of the entire manuscript.
Wow.
So,
oh man, so I don't think I would do that.
But yeah. So for sure, writing from a notebook, you do. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of things where you're just like, there's no way I'm putting that in.
Yeah,
this is a mess.
Yeah.
But and seeing what things look like, you know, in a font on a screen, it gives you a different distance.
Oh, definitely. Well, yeah. Brad, we're out of time, and I've really enjoyed talking to you today.
Me too.
Mom, do you have some closing words for us?
Yeah, I had trouble finding an outtake on this one, but the storyteller in this book, Tess, has done this. Remember yesterday, dream for tomorrow, and live for today.
Ah. That's very great. Appropriate.
All right.
Thank you.
So thank you all very much.
And see you all next week on Writers' Voices.